Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
A week ago on this program, we spoke to art critic Deborah Solomon about her new biography of iconic artist Norman Rockwell. The book is American Mirror, The Life and Art of Norman Rockwell. It is a 493-page account of the life and work of the longtime illustrator for the Saturday Evening Post. Since the release of the book and the recording of our interview with Ms. Solomon, the family of Norman Rockwell has come out saying they are angered by the book and shocked at the suggestions that Rockwell could have been secretly gay or have impulses of a pedophile. In a statement issued by the Norman Rockwell Family Agency, they say, quote, "Ms. Solomon's conclusions demand scrutiny. The family now feels that her purpose in befriending us and writing this fictionalized account was publicity, financial gain, and self-aggrandizement." Thomas Rockwell is Norman Rockwell's second son and an author, perhaps best known for his young adult classic, How to Eat Fried Worms. We welcome him back to the roundtable this morning. Thomas, thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Joe, for having me.
Also, we welcome his daughter and Norman Rockwell's granddaughter, Abigail, to the program. Abigail Rockwell, thank you very much for joining us as well.
Hi, Joe. Thanks so much for having us.
It is a delight to have you with us. This is an interesting story on many accounts and a sad story, certainly, because of the pain that it has caused your family. I'm interested just as a background, because you started out working with Deborah Solomon, right? This was a family decision to cooperate with Deborah Solomon in...
Yes, about 12 years ago, two biographers, Laura Claridge and Deborah Solomon, came to us, and we didn't feel that we wanted to decide between the two. You know, we didn't want to dictate what anyone wrote. So Laura Claridge's biography came out about 10 years ago, and then we didn't hear anything from Deborah Solomon. I believe she was writing a column for the New York Times, but then within the past year and a half, she contacted us again. I think she'd been doing some research during that time. She contacted us again, and we helped her out. I found some a bag of papers that I had about my father, and I shared them with her, and that sort of thing. But then we didn't hear anything until October 22nd, after the book had already come out. And when we read it, frankly, we were very upset.
When you read the book, I'm assuming that it is the headline grabbers, that of the repressed homosexuality, the pedophilic impulses, are the headline grabbers and the things that upset you. Is there other information in the book that you find to be inaccurate and disturbing?
Yes. In fact, we went through and found 96 omissions and errors that had nothing to do with the sexuality. For instance, she just gets addresses wrong, and she didn't really adequately interview my two brothers and myself about 10 or 12 years ago when she first started. She gave us maybe an hour each, or maybe I was 2 hours, and then she, as I said, she vanished for 10 or 12 years, and then when she picked it up, she didn't come and interview us again. So the book is quite a bit off in the last years of my father's life, and of course in the first years of his life. For instance, she doesn't say that in the 1920s he didn't see his parents for 8 or 9 years, even though they lived in adjoining towns, and that, after all, is a very important fact in his life. And then she doesn't talk about his decline. Except very superficially, he wasn't a wealthy man, and so he had to sign prints, even though he wasn't really comprehending what he was doing. Only vaguely, he was following his third wife Molly's directions. And so this, and then he painted a series of portraits that are very poor, John Wayne and Frank Sinatra, which you can see. And then he painted portraits of Ross Perot's family and an associate. And Ross Perot thought they were so bad, and he was right, that he had to return them, and then my father had to return the money. So she misses a whole lot of things like that.
And she didn't give a complete account of the significant difficulty with the Post when the art editor Ken Stewart painted out a horse from one of Pop's covers. That's what I call Pop.
Yes.
Norman Rockwell Pop. He painted out a horse from one of the covers without consulting him, and it was this big thing, and Pop almost quit. And then Ben Hibbs had to step in. He was the managing editor, Dad?
He was the editor.
He was the editor, and he stepped in and saved the day. And from then on, every cover had to be approved by all three editors, so it wasn't all falling under Ken Stewart's decision, and she got that wrong. She also contradicts herself. She says, she explains that Pop resigned from the Post in the 1960s. But then she actually contradicts herself. I think it's a page or two later. She says that Pop was dropped by the Post. So she's just... And one thing that particularly upset me, just personally, was she fictionalized this one incident because it's something that just completely did not happen. At my parents' wedding, I was very, very close to my mother, and she told me everything. And she would always tell me the details of her wedding, and she loved her wedding. And in the book, Solomon says that my grandmother, Mary, got terribly drunk and embarrassed herself.
Right.
And essentially made a scene. And, of course, I asked Dad, and he said, no, nothing like that happened. But then I actually asked some people that were at the wedding, and they immediately, they didn't even have to think about it, and this was, back in 1955. They immediately said, no, your grandmother was dignified and elegant, but she was actually a little quiet and maybe a little removed, but, you know, she was happy to share in the day, you know, when her son was marrying the woman he loved. So that was one thing that just, you know, she completely fictionalized, and that really upset me. I feel so naive that I just didn't think this could happen with a biography, especially from a respected publishing house, that there would be so many falsities and so many errors, such a gross misinterpretation and characterization of Norman Rockwell, of my grandfather. I mean, she doesn't understand the man.
I
doesn't understand who Norman Rockwell was as a person or in his art. You know, she says that on most days he was lonesome and loveless, and this is absurd. You know, Pop did not mope. He wasn't a chronic depressive. You know, he went through his trials and storms, as we all do, but he was somebody who ultimately affirmed life, and I think that's why people connect so emotionally to his work. You know,
I want to read a passage because I want to get to a point. And the passage from the book asks the question, was Rockwell homosexual? And reading from the book, this is page 163 of American Mirror. It depends on what you mean by the word. He demonstrated an intense need for emotional and physical closeness with men. From the viewpoint of 21st century gender studies, a man who yearns for the company of men is considered homosexual, whether or not he has sex with other men. In Rockwell's case, there is nothing to suggest that he had sex with men. The distinction between secret desires and frank sexual acts, though perhaps not crucial to theorists today, was certainly crucial to Rockwell. Granted, he married, but his first marriage and, to some extent, his second were not happy. They seem less genuine, genuine unions than a strategy for passing and controlling his homoerotic desires, whose expression he confined to his art. He was afraid of all physical intimacy, male or female. but decidedly more comfortable in homosocial male groups than in any standard domestic role, be it that of husband, father, or man of the house. I read that in its entirety because when questioned by the Wall Street Journal that asked the question directly to Ms. Solomon, in your book, are you saying that Rockwell was a latent homosexual? She says, I am not a shrink, and I really don't speculate about a life and a person's psychology as a writer. However, this is what, and I'm paraphrasing what she's saying, however, she is an art critic and comes to the conclusion that I just read, according to her, from interpreting the art. Do I have that correct?
Yes, I think what happens during the book is that she seeds the book with all sorts of insinuations about repression and about his liking boys more than men. And she does this all throughout the book, and then in two places she comes out on that, what you read, she comes out about the supposed closeted homosexuality, but in another place further on she comes out and says the same thing about pedophilia, that he had these pedophilic impulses. And she builds this up by innuendo, you know, implying things. For instance, he went out to Hannibal, Missouri, when he was illustrating Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn, and he would, you know, he would do this when he saw somebody that had a wonderful old hat. He would ask for the hat, and so she says about this, but he did enjoy acquiring clothing from men who caught his eye, as if it were possible to acquire the less tangible parts of them as well. You see, and that's a sort of underhanded way of saying that he had these
homoerotic
impulses.
Desires and pedophilic.
And this goes all through the book.
It's a relentless, constant drumbeat of these phantom theories that she's created. And what I've learned recently, you know, I don't know really anything about journalism, but I learned that the art of the newspaper smear is to leave the impression that leads to the conclusion, rather than making a direct accusation. So it's the constant, relentless drumbeat of these insinuations and innuendos that leave this indelible impression. But then if you get to 318, she directly says that he had pedophilic impulses. I can read the quote where it's tricky wordplay, but she very definitively steps from conjecture to stating Norman Rockwell's supposed impulses is fact. I mean, do you want me to read the quote?
Yes, go ahead. I have it here, but go ahead.
Quote, "Once again, we are made to wonder whether Rockwell's complicated interest in the depiction of pre-adolescent boys was shadowed by pedophilic impulses. But an impulse is not a crime. There's no evidence that he acted on his impulses or behaved in a way that was inappropriate for his time." So, you know, here she moves from conjecture to stating his impulses as fact. And, you know, let's be clear, she is stating directly that NR had these pedophilic impulses. She's not speculating. And she doesn't have a shred of evidence to back it up. You know, and this is what she told me herself. She befriended me. I wasn't working with the estate at the time, but about a year before the book was published, she befriended me. And she admitted to me that she had no evidence to back up the fact that she had this absurd notion that Pop was gay. And because she had no evidence, and, you know, we just sort of naively trusted that she wouldn't put it in the book because, you know, there was just no supporting evidence. You know, and I remember she told me this, and I was almost sort of amused because it seemed so absurd, and I asked her, I said, you know, what, is there some secret diary that I don't know about? You know, but there is no secret diary. Norman Rockwell never wrote in any letter or memoir that he had these desires. You know, how in the world does Solomon know what Norman Rockwell felt and what his impulses are if you don't have journals that state that? And she sort of this one innocuous journal entry that she found, it's a journal that's at, in the Norman Rockwell archives at the museum in Stockbridge, it's this one innocuous entry of referring to a camping trip. He right. went on a camping trip with his friend Fred, who is also an artist, and two guides. And, you know, they hunted and fished and they slept in the same bed, but the two guides were in the same bed, over them. This is the 1940s. It's,
right.
a different time. And she says, there's this entry that just says, Fred looks fetching in his long
pajamas.
Flannels.
Yeah.
And she just, it's this innocuous entry, and it actually seems like a joke about
it seems
a guy
humorous.
Long John.
Yeah. We have to take a quick break, and we'll be right back and continue our conversation. Many other issues that I want to get to. We're talking to Thomas and Abigail Rockwell, and the discussion is about Norman Rockwell's legacy. We would we are going to continue the conversation, but first a short break. Welcome back to the roundtable. We are discussing Norman Rockwell with Norman Rockwell's son, Thomas Rockwell, and his granddaughter, Abigail Rockwell, a family very upset over a new biography, American Mirror, The Life and Art of Norman Rockwell. I want to read a quote that is on the back of the book. This is Praise for American Mirror by Deborah Solomon, and it is from Laurie Norton Moffat, the director of the Norman Rockwell Museum, who writes, "American Mirror is a masterpiece, vivid, forthright, and insightful. Through superb research and keen interpretation, Deborah Solomon tells the story of an artist so many thought they knew well and perhaps did not know at all, an epic achievement." I read that quote because I am interested in the image of Norman Rockwell that is painted in this book. And one that seems to be the book launch party for this book was at the Norman Rockwell Museum. And since the family has come out against the book, most of the members of the family have come out and signed this statement. I'm curious, Thomas, of how you feel, if you feel at all betrayed by the Norman Rockwell Museum.
Well, I'll tell you what happened. Laurie Norton Moffat has done a wonderful job building up the museum, you know, from a house in Stockbridge to a wonderful museum. But we have a real disagreement about the biography. Deborah Solomon sent Laurie the galleys back sometime in July, but she didn't send any of the family the galleys. And so when we got them on November 22nd...
No, Dad, it was October 22nd.
October.
October
22nd. We were naturally horrified after we read the book. And so we went up to see Laurie, and we showed her, we had a list of, a 15-page list of our comments, mostly all criticisms, and asked her if they would like to join our statement. And so Laurie said she would consult the board, and she wrote us a letter, but then the board wrote us a letter and said that the museum could not endorse books. They had to be a free and open forum, and they offered us a video interview that would go into the archives of the museum. But
they said they needed to stay neutral, and they suggested that we say nothing and not issue a statement. And what they failed to recognize is that the museum had already endorsed the book with Laurie's lavish endorsement on the dust jacket, and also with the book launch. And the book launch was also televised by C-SPAN.
Right.
Deborah Solomon gave a talk, and that was televised.
So certainly there seems to be from I asked the question. I'm curious because even when I saw that the book was coming out, I had not read the book. I saw the book was coming out. I was interested in interviewing Deborah Solomon. I did not know what the content was, but I saw that it was endorsed by the museum,
right.
and a seeming endorsement. That's what I took it as because of
right.
Because of the jacket, and also because of the fact that there was the the book launch at the museum. And then in addition to that, when I read the book and was many red flags went up for me and contacted the museum and asked them if they had an official response, I did not hear back from them. So I'm curious as to what kind of wedge does that put in between you and the museum, Thomas, and what is your, because how does that work? I mean, you're independent, right? But there are family members on the board.
Yes, there's one family member on the board. My older brother Jarvis's daughter is on the board, but of course the board doesn't. It's very widespread all across the country, so they don't meet very often. You know, I think our attitude is that they made a mistake and that they're continuing the mistake by, you know, continuing to applaud the book on their website and appear on television with Deborah. I mean, not on television, but on radio with Deborah. So this is very concerning, but I think, you know, this is something we'll just have to work out in the future because we do love the museum for what it's done for my father.
But can I ask the question of what do you think? And obviously, this is a question for them, and that's a question we'll ask them. But I'm curious as to what you think, and I'll let you both answer this, of what you think the motivation would be if you were a museum and you were trying to look at a legacy, of what the motivation would be to endorse or surround or accompany yourself with a book that seems to plant seeds that would be far from a flattering portrayal of the legacy of this artist.
I really can't speak to their motives. I was very surprised that if they read the book, they couldn't see for themselves as you did, and you're not a Norman Rockwell expert, but you saw things wrong with it, and they evidently didn't, and I don't understand that, but aside from that, I really don't know what their motives are.
Abigail?
What's very strange is Deborah told me herself, and then Lori admitted this, that Lori requested that a few things be corrected, mainly the characterization of Molly, Pop's third wife. So Lori did have some corrections to make on the book, which is very curious. It's not that she just gave it an endorsement, but she did make these corrections, and Deborah admitted that, and so did Lori.
So the implication being that there was an opportunity to correct this other...
Exactly. And especially to call the family and just say, hey, I just read these galleys. Are you aware of the content of the book? I just wanted to give you a heads up. You know, and I think it's astonishing that we gave Lori the list of the sexual allegations and the other errors and omissions in the book. So she was fully aware at that meeting, and we asked her to join the statement. And with that knowledge, they decided not to join our statement, and they continue to promote the book.
Of course.
So, you know, the one thing I will say is that, at the very least, a number of people are putting they're putting their own personal agenda ahead of Norman Rockwell and the truth. I mean, at the very least.
And again, I guess I get back to motive of the personal agenda of how that benefits the museum, how that benefits. I guess that's where I don't understand quite the connection. I can understand from Deborah Solomon's point of view, because you can say,
right.
a devil's advocate could say, okay, well, you know, this will sell books.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's sensational.
Right.
You know, I think, you know, you can never outrule publicity. I do think that this is a huge literary snow job, and I think a number of people got snowed. And, you know, many of the reviewers have been snowed. They don't know about it. They're not Norman Rockwell scholars. They don't know what's incorrect, factually incorrect in the book. But what I found surprising was that it's so obviously conjecture and speculation on Solomon's part with no evidence. And that seems plain to me, even if you're not a Norman Rockwell scholar. So I think what was so surprising was that the reviewers just accepted and praised the book without ever questioning it. The New York Times, the New York Review of Books did question it.
And there have been several reviews that have been scathing of the book and the material in it. There are quite a few that can be found online that are quite critical of her style and the conclusions that she comes. Well, no, the reviews that have come.
I've only read the ones that are accepting and praising it. So, I mean, except for Amazon.com, you have these extraordinarily intelligent, lucid reviews from,
Well, Patrick Toner's
review. Oh, yes. Professor Toner's article, he wrote, he's a doctor of philosophy at Wake Forest University, and he wrote a brilliant dissection of the book on firstthings.com. It's called False Portrait, and he's an NR scholar, and he has a key into pop that I don't think I've ever encountered in anybody else. Have you, Dad?
No, I think he really has his command of the sources, and it's wonderful. And
the art and who Norman Rockwell was, it's extraordinary.
And he's very good on the art. One thing that one of the troubles with Solomon is that she's an art critic, but she's not very good on the art. For instance, she says about the man standing up in the town meeting and freedom of speech. What does he say, Abigail?
Let me see if I can find the quote.
He's
unattached and sexually unavailable.
Sexually available.
Unattached and sexually available, unbuttoned and unzipped. That's what she sees, in the man that's standing up on freedom of speech. The problem is that these phantom theories about his sexuality, about the pedophilia and the homoerotic urges, color and distort everything, even her interpretations of the art. So you can't separate it out. And a lot of people have been misstating, and she's now saying that the sex part, that's a quote from her, the sex part is a very tiny part of the book.
Right.
It's like four sentences in the book. And that's disingenuous and ludicrous. Dad and I went through the book. We found at least 68 references and passages referring to her theories, these strange phantom theories of his sexuality.
Well, even looking
you can't separate it out.
Even looking at the index under Rockwell and homoerotic, there are many, many page numbers and many things that'll bring you right to that.
I never did that.
The other thing too is that there is what is in the book, and there is also the book tour that she is on. I mentioned the article in the Wall Street Journal, a publication that she works for, but. It says that in one painting, Girl at the Mirror, the question is asked of her, in one painting, Girl at the Mirror, you say that the doll in the picture could be masturbating. Then she goes on to say, who else is masturbating? Rosie the Riveter. And the riveting gun, penis on her lap, and in the background, these pulsating red waves.
Again, women to him were like sexual demons.
I am not an art critic, but I did not get that from that painting. I'm curious. My point is that there is what is in the book, but then there's also this further interpretation that is going on beyond the book. Correct?
Yes.
And I assume. Yes. So let me ask you the question, because this is what has the interview that we did aired last week. I heard from you, Thomas, shortly after it aired, which I greatly appreciated. And the one thing that's been in my mind ever since then has been, I understand the want to protect the family legacy, but by doing this, isn't the concern that you are also drawing attention to a book that seems to want to be sensational? And isn't that a fine line?
Yeah.
Well, I think that is the what most people say. about situations like this, but we felt that the book was getting such favorable reviews from people who really didn't know anything about my father's life at all, and that it was so egregious and out of control that we just had to say something. We couldn't count that people were going to discount it. And she was going on this big tour. She's speaking, I think, this weekend at the Hartford Athenaeum. She's been all over. So
no, that's in January. She's speaking in Vermont this week.
Oh, so we just felt that we couldn't let it go. Though some people did say that. I think that's the first thing that everybody says when you get into a situation like that. But we decided that it was just too much to take. We couldn't throw my father under the bus like that.
You know, you have to sort of come out and stand up for the truth, and you have to fight for it in,
right,
in situations like this. The book was being so accepted that we had to come out. And the sexual allegations have been a significant part of virtually every article and review and online video from the very beginning. And this was starting in mid-October. And I think the Wall Street Journal interview that she did on October 31st, where she goes on about Rosie the Riveter masturbating and that she took this stuff out, I mean, we can only imagine what the book would have been if she hadn't taken these things out. But I think there's this one sentence for me, it comes from that interview, it really says it all. The interviewer asks her, what would be your first question if you could interview Rockwell now? And Solomon answers, I would love to know, who did he lust for in his dreams?
Yeah. I was struck by that.
Who did he lust for in his dreams? I mean, I just think that says it all. It shows where she's coming from. As Professor Toner says, Solomon sees sex virtually everywhere in Rockwell's life and art, and you can't separate it out. And, you know, sometimes in life, you know, you can't remain silent. You have to stand up for the truth. I find it curious that so much of the media didn't want to cover the pedophilia, because that's really the offensive part. You know, Pop wasn't gay, but that's really not the issue. It's that she uses homosexuality and the claims of the homosexuality. She may not say it directly, but she says it in every other way. And she uses that to launch into the pedophilia. And
I found that, I apologize for interrupting, but just to jump in, I found that to be very similar to, in reading it to me as just an outsider reading it, the way I took that was a gross generalization, the same way the generalizations were made during the Catholic Church crisis in the Catholic Church, that if you had a priest and the priest was gay, that they were automatically a pedophile. And certainly there were those cases, but that seemed to be a gross characterization in any case that seemed to be reinforced within what she was writing.
Absolutely. You know, I have a gay friend who read the book, and he found the book very homophobic. He was deeply offended.
But I
was offended.
I bring it up because I'm curious as to the point you make that's interesting is that of why the media has not seized on that particular aspect.
I know, and I think I can't figure out the media. I feel disillusioned with the media at this point and the reviewers. But I think the suggestion of pedophilia blows the credibility of the book out of the water. And so perhaps that's why the reviewers don't really want to delve into it. They don't really want to touch it, because it blows the credibility of the book out of the water.
There's one other facet of all this is that, you know, as you know, probably my father wrote an autobiography.
Yes.
And it was published in 1960. And she makes a very tendentious use of that. She leaves out a lot of episodes where with him with girls and women and things like that. And that's just another example of her way of warping things to fit her thesis.
Yeah, I mean, as Professor Toner said in his article on firstthings.com, Solomon has a pronounced tendency to either distort or simply ignore evidence to the contrary. There are things that she takes from the autobiography, like certain instances, and she'll just say that, and then she twists it and makes it sort of untoward and unseemly. Mm. But then five sentences down, it explains the situation, and it's totally innocuous. You know, there's this part where she goes, it's how she introduces the pedophilia on page 94, where she brings up, you know, how Pop in the autobiography, it mentions that he used to visit schools at recess to find boys as models. And she omits the part, she brings that up, and then she has this quote about, you know, this is in our awareness of pederasty scandals, meaning pedophilia, this kind of behavior might seem problematic. So this is how she introduces the pedophilia. But she omits the rest of the story, which is Pop would you know, talk with the boys, and he would convince them, and then they would go to the mother to ask her permission, and then the mothers would always go, oh, my gosh, we're more than pleased to have you pose for Norman Rockwell.
Right.
So she and that's what she did. Like, Pop will give these charming little anecdotes. He'll make fun of himself. There was an incident about Pop was self-conscious about his pot belly, so he went to a corset shop that was for men and women, and he wore it was at the Miss Universe. He was judging the Miss Universe contest. The Miss America contest. And he makes this funny little anecdote about it, and she then takes this, you know, little charming anecdote and turns it and makes it unseemly and untoward, and she says, this is Rockwell's entry into cross-dressing.
Mm.
You know, and the problem is, as Patrick Toner points out in his article again, you know, it's his entry and his exit, because Pop never, you know, wore a corset again, and he admitted he was wearing it because he was self-conscious about his belly.
Laughing at himself.
Yeah, he was completely laughing, and he wasn't ashamed of himself, and he's a, you know, I think the thing that is so missed, you know, she keeps hounding the fact that he's repressed. Pop was surprisingly open and candid for somebody of his generation, and I think it's because of the years in the 1950s in his therapy with Eric Erickson. But he was surprisingly candid and open about these anecdotes that some men would be like, oh, I don't want to tell the corset story, you know, I'm kind of ashamed of that. You know, Pop was just, you know, he would just sort of state things and make a funny story out of it. And, you know, she just missed his humor and his humanity. And it just
I have a few more questions that I'm wondering. Yeah. We're going to go a little bit longer here, but do you have another 10 minutes or so?
Sure. Oh,
okay.
Thank you.
So let me go to a break, and then we'll come back, and then there's a couple of other things that I want to get to.
Okay.
And we'll do that. We're talking to Abigail and Thomas Rockwell. We're talking about Norman Rockwell and his legacy and the family's upset over the book American Mirror. We'll be back after this short break. Welcome back to the roundtable. We are joined by Thomas Rockwell, who is Norman Rockwell's second son, as well as his daughter, Norman Rockwell's granddaughter, Abigail Rockwell. They are family members who are very upset over a new biography, American Mirror, by Deborah Solomon, and we've been discussing that during this hour of the roundtable. Just a couple of things that I want to get to before we go. And one is, there seems to be, obviously family dynamics are complex. And when you look at, when the statement was released by the family, that came out as from, the Norman Rockwell Family Agency. What is that?
Well, the Norman Rockwell Family Agency is the vehicle that we set the family set up to handle the licensing and questions. You know, so somebody didn't have to call eight or nine members of the family to use a work of my father's in a book. And My younger brother lives in Rome, where he is now, and his four children live, one lives in Canada and San Francisco and Boston and New Hampshire. So it was very difficult to try to coordinate it. They all of the family but two, in other words, 8 out of 10, agreed to the statement, but a couple of members of the family didn't feel that they wanted to join in.
And I just want to clarify this point. When you say 8 out of 10, so of those who did not, they are not saying that they agree with the content of the book. It was more that, from my understanding, that it was more they just did not want to get involved in the controversy. Is that correct?
Yes, that was it.
We're not even sure they read the book. So,
okay, so it wasn't that they were saying, yes, we also perhaps have these notions as well.
No, not at all.
Okay.
Not at all.
And can we take it that so which brings me to the question of, and again, I don't want to put you on the spot of having to answer for them, and we will ask them ourselves, but do you think that there is is it your concern that there is a perception that could be brought to the American people and to people and to art lovers and certainly those who love and respect your father, that because the Norman Rockwell Museum, which is the preeminent institution that looks after the art of your father and grandfather, that by not joining the statement that they believe that this to be true?
I really can't answer that. Certainly, the endorsement sounds as if they believe it, but I just can't believe if they really look through the book and consider it closely that they would agree with it.
Thomas, also,
we, of course, have to ask them.
Yes, absolutely. You know, I think, Thomas, that their family dynamics are difficult and complex, and I think all of us understand that and know that. And of course, to be a family that is in the spotlight is even more difficult. So when you are left with dealing with something like this, And of course I don't think it's not untrue to say that that at times your relationship was strained with your father. Is that accurate?
No, my relationship was never strained with my father.
We
had a very good time. I helped him with his autobiography, and that was a lot of fun. And I don't think I was ever had a strained relationship with him.
But
and my mom was really close to Pop also, and
she was, my wife was also close to my mother.
So how does this?
I mean, we all adored Pop. I mean, we all adored Pop, and
so I guess my question is how does this leave? I mean, I would think if these things were said about my father, who I had a very close relationship with, it sounds like you did too, then I would be. I'd be doing exactly what you're doing, being mad as hell and not going to take it anymore. But I mean, I would think there would be a really emotional toll as well.
Thank you for noticing.
this has been, I can't even describe to you, it's been a harrowing nightmare, Joe. And the only thing that gets me through it is the thought that you can't outrun the truth. And I really do have faith that the truth will ultimately prevail. But it's taken my father won't say this to you, but it's taken a terrible toll on him. I think there have been so many moments in this process where Dad and I have just looked at each other and we just say, we can't believe that we're having to face this and that these things are being said. And, you know, because as a family, we had never tried to hide anything. We had, we'd always been open and
right.
Admitted that there, you know, there was mental illness and alcoholism in the family. And we just never, ever dreamed that somebody could do this, you know, because it's basically salacious lies in the guise of a well-researched scholarly book. And it's an unconscionable betrayal of trust.
So with what you just said about you can't outrun the truth, do you think that this book will just go away and will not, that the legacy, I mean, look,
the paintings went for $58 million. I mean, the legacy seems to be very, very strong, right?
Right.
And
yes, I don't think this. I do have to say that I don't think this is going to affect the art. And as a matter of fact, Solomon says that she likes the art and she's thinking of it as really art, not just something lower like illustration. So from that standpoint, we're very happy that and most of the reviews have said that. But it's just that they've so distorted my father's life and then read it into the art that we felt we had to say something.
Well, I am very happy that you came on our program to talk about this, and I know it is a trying time and difficult to talk about, and I appreciate you both being so open and honest with us this morning. Thomas Rockwell and Abigail Rockwell, we think of you. We thank you very much for spending time, and we hope you both have a delightful holiday season.
Oh, thank you so much, Joe.
Yes,
thank you so much for having me.
You have wonderful questions. Thank you.
A great pleasure.
Merry Christmas.
And to you. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Again, you can find out more information. There are some wonderful sources about this online. We'll have them posted on our site soon. It is roundtable at WAMC. It's WAMC.org/roundtable. WAMC.org/roundtable. You're listening to the Roundtable on WAMC.